Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you are watching TV at my house, like so many houses across America, you are likely to hear one of these themes. The man binding all those shows together is Michael Schur. He was a writer and producer for The Office. He co-created Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He created The Good Place. And he joins me in the studio now. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Holy cow. That is such a resume. Was there some point where you like figured out you were funny?
No. Still no. I got into comedy when I was a kid. I loved Monty Python and I loved Saturday Night Live, like so many kids who are between the ages of, say, 10 and 14. And then I just sort of kept trying it. I went to Harvard and wrote for the Lampoon. So I'm a local kid. That's part of why I'm happy to be here right now. And it just sort of was the thing I always liked doing. So I don't know. There wasn't one lightning bolt moment or anything like that.
Do you remember the first thing that you wrote that was legit funny?
Still waiting. No,
I think some of it's funny. I gotta tell you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's kind of you. I really don't. I read Woody Allen's books. Woody Allen wrote collections of comedy essays, little comedy pieces, Without Feathers and Getting Even and Side Effects, and I read those when I was probably 11 or 12, and I started trying to imitate them. And I would sit, I had a typewriter, and I would just write terrible, terrible imitations of them. And none of them were remotely funny, but that was the first time I at least tried. I don't think I probably wrote anything legitimately funny till I was at least in high school. We did a parody of the school newspaper and snuck out a secret sort of parody edition. And it's all dumb high school inside jokes at the time. But I think there was some actually legitimately funny stuff in that. I'll
so
go with that.
Somewhere in high school you found your funny.
That's right.
So I have long believed that you're really lucky if you have like one original or really big idea in your life. You have four shows. Four shows that are widely considered sort of groundbreaking and brilliant. With any of them, did you kind of have a sense, oh, we're really onto something here, or has every success been a surprise for you?
Well, the first thing to say about them is some of them are attributable to me and a lot of them are not. A lot of them are collaborations. In other words, Brooklyn Nine-Nine I created with my friend Dan Gore, who I've known for 25 years, and The Office was adapted by Greg Daniels, who's the genius who taught me how to do this job, and then he and I created Parks and Rec together. So much of this stuff is collaborative, and including the very fundamental ideas that lead to them. So it's not false modesty to deflect a lot of the credit. The only one of those shows that I really fully created myself is The Good Place. And I felt like I was onto something with the idea, but I also felt like, boy, this is a really big swing, and this might be rough. So the fact that it has stuck around has been very gratifying, because I felt like it was an interesting idea, but I really didn't know whether it would work or not on network TV.
All right, so let's talk about The Good Place,
sure.
Which you have to understand, in my family, that is the TV show that the whole family watches
together.
Oh,
really?
I have teenagers. We love The Good Place.
Thank you.
It is a super geeky, it's ethics, right? It is a comedy about ethics. So where did you get that idea, and how'd that come about? And did Sob Guy, have I heard that Sob Guy has something to do with this?
There's a lot of individual kind of genesis points that kind of accumulated over the years. One thing that happened is when I drive around Los Angeles, which is a terrible way to spend your time, if people would sort of cut me off or do something obnoxious, which happens, 12 to 15 times an hour, my way of avoiding road rage was to just say, that guy just lost 10 points. Like, I was sort of imagining a video game, a sort of ethical video game that we're all playing, and I would assign people points if they did nice things, and I would take them away if they did bad ones. And then there were other moments in my life, different like little events that where I found myself immersed in some kind of weird moral dilemma. And it became a passion accidentally, like studying ethics. It became a sort of a way for me to untangle odd moments in my life that I really enjoyed. And I love talking to people about it. I think it's a fascinating subject. So when it was time, when Parks and Recreation was ending and I was looking for a new show, I sort of thought like, well, the ultimate personal goal would be to somehow do a show about ethics. And that's sort of where it came from.
So we're going to give our listeners a flavor of the show. So just for people who don't know the premise, this happens in the afterlife.
Right.
And I don't want to give too much away, but we've got a series of characters. Michael is the architect of the afterlife. The main character is Eleanor, who mm-hmm. by all measures was not a very good person when
Correct.
She was on Earth. And here we also have Chidi, who is an ethicist. And Michael is making a famous ethical dilemma called the trolley problem very real for Chidi.
Oh, God! Michael, what did you do?
I made the trolley problem real so we could see how the ethics would actually play out. There are five workers on this track and one over there. Here are the levers to switch the tracks. Make a choice.
The thing is, I mean, ethically speaking...
No time, dude! Make a decision!
Well, it's tricky! I mean, on the one hand, if you ascribe to a purely utilitarian worldview...
Okay. So... what did we learn?
So he kills a lot of people.
Yes, he does. They're not real people, it should be noted. This is a sort of a simulacrum of the trolley problem where Michael sort of snapped his fingers and suddenly Chidi, instead of teasing out this kind of vague theoretical problem of if you're on a trolley, the brakes fail, and you're about to kill five people, do you pull a lever and kill one person on a different track? Michael snaps his fingers and puts them on a real trolley. But I want everyone to know that the people that he just smushed are not real people.
But he smushes people repeatedly
he
as
does,
he goes
yes.
through this. I know of university ethics professors who use this now as the way that they teach the trolley problem.
Yeah.
But it's also insanely funny. How did you know that you could make ethics this fun and funny as a regular show premise?
I didn't know it. I suspected it. And the reason I suspected it is that when you read philosophy, which I have done a lot of in the last four or five
funny.
Years. No, it's not. But sometimes you get to something like the trolley problem, where a philosopher will try to illustrate his or her, in this case her, point by creating a sort of thought experiment. And the trolley problem, famously, is that one you just listened to. If you're on a trolley, the brakes fail, you're going to kill five people. Do you pull a lever and go to the other side? That, to me, is hilarious. I mean, what a terrible thing to make you decide.
Kill one and then, or kill five.
Yeah, right. and then if you read about the trolley problem, it keeps going. There's all these iterations. If you were a doctor, would you kill, and there are five patients who each need an organ, would you kill a sort of innocent janitor in the hospital who's just minding his own business, sweeping up, and harvest his organs? It's like, what is going on in this town that all of these dilemmas are occurring? So that I thought, early on in the show, I really had this thought, which was if I can just get to the trolley problem, I always knew I wanted to do an episode about it. And I thought if I can hang on long enough to get to that episode, which didn't happen until season two, I felt pretty safe. I felt like we had something. It has now become a teaching tool. We've heard from a lot of professors who use it, which makes sense, right? If you're trying to teach a bunch of bored freshmen and try to get them interested in philosophy, it helps to show them a funny video of Ted Danson and Kristen Bell and Will Harper. It's much better than reading dry texts.
Right. So you explore a lot of philosophical issues in the show. And spoiler alert to listeners, I am about to tell something from season three. You reveal in the most recent season that no one has earned enough points to make it into the good place in a very, very long time. Basically, the system is rigged.
Right.
And if it's rigged, then you go to hell no matter what. So is there a point to being good? Because it's actually the goodness of the characters, bizarrely, even though they're sort of bad, that is so charming about the show.
Well, the way the system of the world of the show works is you're basically playing that ethical video game I was talking about, and there's a point total, and people who hit the point total go, up to the good place, and people who don't go down to the bad place. It's a very binary, very cold, steely mathematical system, and in season three, they sort of found out that no one's gotten in 500 years, basically, and the question of whether it's important to be good and the system are almost not related, because in the world of the show, the reason no one has gotten in is because life has just gotten too complicated. It used to be if you did a simple good act, you would get X number of points. But now, you know, that simple good act, you know, calling your aunt on her birthday, now you're using a cell phone that was mined, toxic materials were mined to make it, and it was made in a sweatshop in China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the number of points you got for that simple good act has fallen dramatically over the last 1,000 years. That's a critique of the world we live in. The other question is it a good idea to try to be good? And the show very stalwartly says, yes, it is. And in fact, what it says more specifically is it's important to try. That the actual, if you try to be a good person, you're going to fail a lot. You're going to fail every day. We all do, even with the best of intentions, you're going to fail. And so the show has sort of taken the position that what's important isn't, are you a good person? That's the wrong question. The question is, are you trying to be good? Are you thinking about what you're doing, why you're doing it, whether you could be doing something better? And I think that's where in this, we're heading into our final season now. We're ending the show after season 4, which debuts soon. And that is kind of the end game of the show, is to say what's important is that you're thinking about this stuff and that you're trying.
So if that's such an important message, you're ending the show on a high. Why not keep going with it?
Well, from the very beginning, the show moved very quickly. I've worked in TV for a long time now, and there are certain sort of rhythms that shows fall into. And the basic premise of the first episode was you are introduced to this perfect utopia, this reward for living a good life. And there's a woman there, played by Kristen Bell, who definitely is there by mistake. Something went wrong and she's there by mistake.
Wrong.
Yes, she is definitely not. And she knows it instantly. And so I thought, like, well, the normal rhythm of a TV season will mean that what people are expecting is that the last episode of the season, she gets found out. And so because that's what everyone's going to be expecting, I'm going to do that 6 episodes in. We're going to accelerate everything. And accelerating the storytelling made the show really feel like it was careening forward. It had a ton of momentum. And we took things that would normally happen in the second season and we moved them up to the first, and from the third and moved them up into the second. And so because of that, we just ended up chewing through the whole story that we wanted to tell very quickly. So, you know, I felt like at the beginning of season 2, when the show was going to stick around, I sort of thought, like, I think this is about 50 or so episodes. It feels like that's the right number. I kept an open mind to in case I was wrong and some new avenues arose, but it just became clear that was the right amount. So we just decided to sort of end it on our own terms and say this is the length of the story we want to tell.
All right. So we've got listeners who love some of your other shows as well. Let's talk about those. And I want to talk about Parks and Rec. So I'm from the Midwest. My brother was the mayor of Battle Creek, Michigan.
Oh, great. I'm from Ann Arbor.
All right. There you go. I went to school in Ann Arbor. My brother was the mayor of our city and the head of Parks and Recreation.
Really?
Actually. And there is so much authenticity to Parks and Rec. And I'm wondering how much you base these characters on real people versus, did you pick an actor? Did you pick a character? I mean, how real were you trying to make Parks and Rec?
Very real. Greg and I did a lot of research. We went to a bunch of different local governments. We talked to a lot of people. We talked to city planners. We talked to people who work in Parks and Rec departments. We went to town council meetings, public meetings, public forums, which are wonderful and hilarious. I'll give you one example. So we had the idea for the character Ron Swanson, played by Nick Offerman. And the idea was there's a guy who works in local government but is an avowed libertarian who wants to essentially dismantle and destroy the government from the inside. And we thought that was a funny idea. So we went to a town near L.A. and we were talking to this woman and we said, let me ask you a question. We have the design for this character, works in government but wants to destroy it. He's a libertarian. Is that just too absurd to be realistic? And she said, no, I'm a libertarian. and we said, really? And we just kind of stared at her and she went, I'm aware of the irony. And we were like, okay, I guess that person exists. So a lot, you know, some of it was based on, it wasn't really based on real people, but we spent a lot of time with people who work in those jobs and absorbed all of that stuff like a sponge.
Let's hear a little bit of Parks and Rec too. This is the scene where they are making a town time capsule and trying to decide what should go in it.
So that's what today's forum is for. We're going to hear suggestions from everyone, and then whichever items we generally agree on will go into the time capsule. Please remember, this is a government project, so we need to refrain from corporate promotion and religious items. Who'd like to start?
I think we should put in the Bible.
Great.
So people go on to argue about, you know, I want Twilight books, a picture of someone's cat. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous, but it feels like a pretty authentic representation of what people care about, the very personal things people care about in their own communities.
Yes, and when you go to those meetings, it's sort of heartwarming because anyone, in most meetings like that, anyone can stand up and talk for 2 minutes. That's sort of a general rule of thumb at public forums like that. And people stand up and they say crazy things. They have some axe to grind about something. And it's messy and it takes a long time and people kind of tune out. But it's also sort of beautiful. It's like a beautiful aspect of democracy that the people who represent us have to go in front of us from time to time. Even if they ignore us completely, we get to say what's on our mind. And Leslie Knope, played by Amy Poehler, was a person, a character who deeply believed that was valuable and important, that people get to stand up and say whatever they want, they get to care about whatever they want, and that she had to be responsive. It's a little bit of a fantasy.
Yeah,
could
you do that show today? Could you do that kind of sweet optimism today?
You know, I've been asked that many times. I think so, and I don't frankly think we would change anything because it wasn't – the show happened to be conceived of around the time of the financial crisis, and Greg Daniels and I talked a lot about how – in one way or another, the government was going to be playing a more active role in people's lives. And so we were like, well, let's do a show about where the rubber meets the road, like local government, not abstract federal TARP bailout government, but just I need a stop sign on my corner kind of government. And we designed the character with Amy Poehler, and that was the point of it. The point of it was just what happens? Who are the people who have to be responsive on an individual level at the local level? I don't think anything would change. I think it might be reflected, the thoughts of the audience might be reflected back to us a little differently because it's not like we're picking ourselves up by our bootstraps and trying to recover from this giant economic crisis, but rather we're in the midst of incredible turmoil and how do you find a path forward? But Leslie wouldn't change. I think we would present her in the show, I think, the same way.
All right. Well, there were 800 other things I was supposed to ask you, but I let it get away from us. So that's Good Place creator Michael Schur. The final season of The Good Place premieres September 26th on NBC. And Michael Schur and William Jackson Harper, who plays Chidi Adegonye on The Good Place, will be at WBUR City Space tonight at 6:30. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.